Welcome to Stanza's opening night podcast. We had a delightful opening night, and this podcast tries to capture just a little bit of the excitement of being there. We've got an interview with sculptor David Mach about his sculpture of Burns and his intention to burn it. We've got poems from New Zealand poet Bill Manheyer and Scottish poet Kate Clancy. We've got the opening speech from Scotland's First Minister Alex Salmond. And we're extremely privileged to have an amazing traditional rendering of My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose by the internationally acclaimed folk musician Sheena Wellington. We start off with an interview with David Mach, the sculptor, conducted by Stanza's very own Peggy Hughes.
So listen, tell us a bit about the Burns Big Heed. Like, how does that idea?
Oh, it's funny, isn't it? Robbie Burns. Robbie Burns. He literally... he actually does burn in this case.
He does.
We made his head... funny thing about that, when you decide to do a portrait of Burns, you discover that... Where are all the photographs of Burns? You know, like I'm like a cultural backwater, you know, a bit of a desert, you know. What do you mean photographs? Can't I get photographs of Robert Burns?
What he looks like.
See, but the funny thing is, you've only got like one or two things you can actually reference, you know.
Just the portraits and stuff.
Well, there's a couple of portraits. There's not much.
Yeah.
So we don't really know what this guy looked like. I mean, man, this guy must have been sexy as all hell.
Well, this is it.
He was shagging every woman.
He was having fun.
Man, he's like the first. He was the first rock star. This guy, certainly the first Scottish rock star.
Surely.
Definitely. And man, he was milking it.
So how did you then sort of like decide on the dimensions and everything? Like, did you just guesswork just by looking at a portrait? You thought.
Look at it. Some of those paintings. I mean, although there's only one or two paintings, I think it was Naismith that one of them. You know, so they're so good, you can guess, I guess, you know, how the rest of it's going to go. But, I mean, it's not really about that, I suppose. Although, if I'd made a really kind of abstract, you know, strange-looking, you know, social realist, which would have been pretty appropriate, I guess.
With all of this. And what about the burning procedure itself? You were talking earlier
The burning procedure's fun. It's good, you know?
And how long should we expect it?
Isn't it great? One of the Scotland's greatest kind of hero, kind of, you know, bit, you know, you know, Robbie Burns sort of hovers above Scotland like some sort of great kind of god-like figure. People would talk about him before they'd ever talk about Scotland. And what are you going to make your portrait with? Bronze, you know, jewels, you know, gold? No, matches. You know?
Yeah.
You know, it's the kind of thing that you're reduced to as Robert Burns, superstar, incredible poet, blah, blah, blah. Your face may appear on the back of a book of matches. If you're very, very lucky. And that, well, still only count in Scotland. That's not going to impress the hell out of us. Oh, no. You know?
We're Scots.
We don't give a about anything. Yeah.
Cool. And so after it's done, it turns into something completely different.
You lose the colour. But you get this kind of... You take something...
It's spectral, it sounds like.
There's a real kind of spectacle, but it's a very short-lived one. It's like, you know, 30 seconds. Very intense. And you know, we go from this kind of sophisticated bar theatre... You know, middle class kind of setting to all of a sudden we're all naked around a campfire screaming. You know?
That's poetry.
And then we're back to
civilization
again.
Well, thanks to David and to Peggy for that amazing interview. And indeed, Robert did burn. And photos should be available on the website. Bill Manheyer was New Zealand's inaugural poet laureate, and he has been called a poet of subtlety and strength. Stanza is extremely honoured to have Bill Manheyer as its 2009 Poet in Residence.
I'm very glad to be here because a 26-hour journey by air needs a payoff, and this is a pretty good payoff. The homecoming year means quite a bit to me. I just arrived by train from London, as it happens, and my grandfather was a signalman on the Edinburgh King's Cross line. His daughter, my mother, met my father during the Second World War. She'd won a scholarship to Mary Erskine School for Girls and then completed a BSc at Edinburgh University. And she was a high school teacher when she met my father, who happened to be a New Zealand naval officer, so probably looked faintly glamorous at the time. They met in Edinburgh, and they honeymooned here in St Andrews, where I've never been before, so I'm really pleased to be here. And I have a horrible suspicion that my father really wanted to play golf. My mother then sailed south to New Zealand on a ship filled with war brides. That was the total cargo. My father met her in Wellington on St. Valentine's Day, 1946, and they drove down the west coast of the South Island to Invercargill. And she once told me that she remembers thinking, as they sat in that car, that they could just drive and drive forever and never get to Scotland. In a way, she did get to Scotland because she got to a place called Invercargill, which is one of the, I think it's probably the southernmost place of Scottish settlement. Every street in the city centre of Invercargill is named after a Scottish river, so you can walk down Dee Street and turn left into Tay Street or right into Clyde Street and so on. Invercargill is also New Zealand's, as I think I might have said, southernmost city. Rudyard Kipling called it the last lamppost in the world. And my mother now made the difficult discovery that the naval officer she had married had spent his youth dreaming of running a pub. So she now found herself as far from home as she could possibly be, and not a school teacher, but a publican's wife. So tough for her, lucky for me. My mother, Maisie, died just over a year ago in New Zealand, and so I thought I would read one poem which acknowledges her life here. During the war, she and some other teachers at the school she was teaching at were involved in teaching English to Polish soldiers. And I remember that she occasionally told me about a particular Polish soldier before she met my father, whom she clearly had a bit of a crush on. Anyway, this poem, just the one poem I want to read, I think is pretty self-explanatory. You can hear me in it almost trying to write the poem as it goes along with sort of nagging questions. And you can hear her voice replying. So this poem, oddly enough, is called The English Teacher. My mother was teaching Polish soldiers. Each day at 4 o'clock they marched down to the school. This was in Scotland, Preston Pans, near Edinburgh. Salt pans, says my mother. The monks would make salt in the pans. They needed the language for the invasion of Europe. Also, they wanted to meet people. Everyone likes to get along socially. There was a dashing sergeant. He had only the one word of English. At the end of each class, he clicked his heels, opened a silver case, and said, "Cigarette?" But my mother didn't smoke. She stood at the blackboard cleaning off phrases. Just words, she says, only expressions. I am a soldier. I am your friend. My mother was in her late 20s. I didn't know your dad then. He was in San Francisco in a nightclub called The Lion's Den. Or he was waking at dawn in the state of Nevada on a train crossing America. While among the Poles there was one, a sad man who stood out from the bunch. The Russians had locked him away back when they were still helping Hitler. He had been a carpenter, but his wife and children, they might be dead, might be anywhere. He might never know where they were. The long trains labored south, with their troops and ammunition, two engines in front and one at the back. The soldier made a wooden plaque and left it with my mother, also a thank you letter. Give me more detail, I say, you know, to put in the poem. But what happened to the plaque, my mother can't remember. It was lovely, she says. All she recalls is the carpenter's sadness. The letter she carried all the way to New Zealand, till somewhere in the South Island, shifting from place to place, packing or unpacking, somehow she lost it. Someone had written it out for him, maybe one of the officers. Yours faithfully, it said, or yours sincerely, and every last word was set down correctly. Thank you.
We now have the opportunity to listen to some poems from the acclaimed poet, Kate Clanchy.
I came up from England today into Scotland, and there starts that great weighing of the heart of how Scottish are you. So I think I might lay claim to my one truly Scottish grandparent, my grandfather, who came from Fountain Bridge, like Sean Connery, and was just as handsome, always looked like a film star, and completely invented himself. He started as a bridge sharp and ended as a potato merchant. He was bankrupt twice in his life. This is his watch strap, which he swapped in 1952 for a load of potatoes. The man from Cyprus. My grandfather. His head was grand and mottled as a planet. There were no maps. His rage sprang up, mysterious as geysers. The continents were dark where his several brothers lived, though Uncle James from Africa once showed up in the flesh. And if there were, in the frozen poles, the hole he put his father in long ago, I never knew nor dare to ask. He was munificent and vast. This is all I know for sure. Grandad looked like old Duke Wayne and shot birds with the Earl of Cairn. He had cigars and a Jaguar, and his father was a gas fitter. He beat us all at dominoes, but drew black, black one day and died. Because of him, we are not self-made. He left us that. Aunt Katie's rug and a drawer full of cashmere socks, luxurious and muffling, easily worn to holes. It's difficult to choose where you live, I think. I'm going to read three poems to warn you. when my granddad died, everything he'd invented for himself was stripped away, and he told me he couldn't shut his eyes because every time he shut his eyes, his aunties came for him. His terrible aunties in Fountain Bridge. Home time. When my grandfather died, he saw, he said, not death's bare head, but aunts, his antique aunts in crackling black, come to call him back from play. Those difficulties with belonging, I wrote a poem about that once when I was stuck. I always thought about whether I was English or Scottish when I was going up the East Coast line. And you go over the bridge at Berwick-upon-Tweed, which of course isn't the border, but it is the contested place, isn't it? And that's where England and Scotland meet. And this is a poem about that train journey. The bridge over the border. Here, I should surely think of home, my country, and the neat, steep town where I grew up, its banks of cloud, the winds and changing, stagey light, its bouts of surly, freezing rain. Or failing that, the time the train stuck here half an hour. It was hot for once. The engine seemed to grunt and breathe with us, and in the hush, the busker at the back plucked out Scotland the Brave. There was a filmic golden light, and the man opposite was struck, he said, with love. He saw a country in my eyes, but he was from Los Angeles. And I was thinking of another bridge. It was October. I was running to meet a man with whom things were not quite settled, were not, in fact, to ever settle. And I stopped halfway to gaze at birds, swallows in their distant thousands, drawn to Africa or heat or home, not knowing which, but certain how. Shifting on the paper sky, they were crosses and stock market graphs. They were sand in a hoop shaken sideways, and I stared as if panning for gold. Maybe one more poem, right, then I will get down, I'll get down, get down, get down. I don't think you can choose your home necessarily. I'm just going to read when I wrote my first poem, I was extremely surprised to find myself using the Scots phrase, I know fine, which is not something I would say in speech, and a Scottish title as well. And I think that your national identity and where you come from kind of comes up and mugs you more than you necessarily affiliate with it. I'll be short and I'll get off and leave you to do. I have to explain what slattern means in English, but I think people up here will know that it's a woman who doesn't peel the potatoes properly, and that also that the person telling me to pull myself together is undoubtedly my mother at the end. Slattern. I leave myself about slatternly, bits of me in times I liked. I let them go on lying where they fall, crumple if they will. I know fine how to make them walk and breathe again. Sometimes at night or on the train, I dream I'm dancing or lying in someone's arms who says he loves my eyes in French. And again, I'm walking up your road that first time, bidden and wanted, the blossom and the trees, light, light and buoyant. Pull yourself together, they say, quite rightly. But she's stubborn, that girl, that hopeful one, still walking.
And now it's over to Eleanor Livingston to introduce a very special guest.
We've heard the first poetry of the festival, now for the first song. We are delighted and honoured to have taken part in Stanza this year, Scotland's leading traditional singer, acclaimed around the world and who famously sang for the reopening of the Scottish Parliament. Please welcome Sheena Wellington.
Like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June, and my love's like the melody that's sweetly played in tune. As fair art thou, my bonny lass, deep in love am I. And I will love thee still, my dear, till all the seas run dry. Till all the seas run dry, my dear, and rocks melt with the sun. I will love thee still, my dear, while the sun's old life still run. And fare thee well, my only love, and fare thee well a while. For I will come again, my love, for 10,000 mile. For my love's like a red, red rose.
It was indeed a privilege to listen to Sheena Wellington sing that beautiful version of My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose. And now we have Brian Johnson introducing Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond.
Now, one of the particular ideas that has come out of Homecoming, which is one I'm really fond of, is the notion of an affinity Scot, someone who has a connection with Scotland, who is educated here, who's lived here for a while, who has lovely memories of Scotland and really wishes to come back and identify with the country. And I would like to introduce our guest speaker, Mr. Salmond, as an affinity St. Andrean. He is, like both Eleanor and myself, a graduate of the University of St. Andrews, a graduate we're all very proud of, and I would like you all now to welcome the First Minister, Alex Salmond.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, can I say, Brian, first, how shocked, absolutely shocked I am to find out you were merely ticking the boxes of the Homecoming campaign. Homecoming is a fantastic concept, a worthy celebration of the 250th anniversary of National Bard, a fantastic excuse without any hint of corruption whatsoever for me to give vast dollops of money to my favourite causes in my favourite town. Well, actually, modest amounts of money, but nonetheless, the thoughts there, Bill, and I'm glad you ticked the appropriate boxes. Can I say what a wonderful start to this year's stanza. I was interested, Bill, in your life story. As far as I can make out, you might well have been conceived at St Andrews in your parents' honeymoon. Now, when we were embracing the idea of homecoming, but to take it to the extent of coming back to the very point of conception, this is absolutely extraordinary that from the first New Zealand poet laureate should take matters to heart. We are very privileged indeed, Bill, to have your presence here today. And Kate, I was delighted to hear about the Fountain Bridge background, the same background as the world's most famous Scot, Sir Sean Connery. A few years ago, I managed to persuade and inveigle Sir Sean, actually, was playing golf at the St Andrews at the time, to do a party political broadcast on behalf of the Scottish National Party, and we got about 10,000 calls, because the last thing he had to say was, if you want to join the SNP, phone 031-226-3661. Actually, the number's changed, folks, if you're not it down. And 10,000 calls, and 95% of the calls were from women. And now, you know, at that time, I mean, he was only 70 or so, but he was the world's greatest sex symbol. And I thought, even so, 95% from women. Then I had another look at the tape, and of course, in Sean speak, the last thing he said was, if you want to join the SNP, then phone 031-226-3661. Clearly, the inspiration for much of your poetry, Kate. And Sheena, back to when I knew you first, you were staying in Largo Ward. But you got out of there, didn't you, Sheena? Yeah. And Sheena's the most amazing singer. And the My Love's Like a Red, Red Rose is actually Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan quotes My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose as his inspiration, as the greatest song. And I've often wondered about it, because I love the traditional, the authentic tune that Sheena has just graced us with. I don't actually like the tune that we're more familiar with, and I've always wondered why on earth Bob Dylan should think that was the greatest song. Obviously, Aphone Kiss is much, much better, for example, but sung as you did it, Sheena, with the authentic tune, I think I can now understand why Bob Dylan cites it as his greatest inspiration. My favourite moment of many in listening to Sheena Wellington, of course, was the opening of the Scots Parliament, the reopening, the reconvening of the Scots Parliament in 1999, the official opening, and Sheena sang A Man's a Man for All That, as in, and I won't sing it, although I'm better. Nah. Hands up who wants me to sing it. No, sorry, folks. This democracy stuff can be taken far too far, you know. This PR's bad enough, but to go by votes, well, anyway, you know the thing. You see on Burke, God a Lord that struts on stairs and all that, the hundreds worship at his word, he's but a coup for all that. For all that and all that, his ribbon star and all that, the man of independent mind looks and laughs at all that. Now, that's just to demonstrate the First Minister read a book once, you know what I mean? Anyway, Sheena was singing this so beautifully, and as she got to the end, the entire Parliament rose as one to sing a Man's a Man with Sheena, and it was just a fantastic emotional moment. But I was standing about 2 or 3 feet away from the Duke of Edinburgh. You see, and Duke of Edinburgh, to join in, and good on him, you know, started to sway gently back and forward like this, you know. And Sheena's going, you see on Burke, caught a lot. The Duke of Edinburgh's going, you know. And I've always wondered, did he take in the full extent of the Scots, Sheena? Was he fully understanding what he was kind of joining into and the revolutionary concepts that lay behind it? So I was trying to find something that kind of leapt beyond any kind of academic study of Burns and was more personalised. And that way, obviously, I couldn't be picked up by all these folk, including Robert Crawford, incidentally, who was sitting in the front row. And incidentally, none of what I did and said in my personalised way stopped Robert Crawford from picking me up in a few points of detail, but that's another story. A fantastic occasion, but I was just trying to think, you know, what about the American audience and Burns' poetry? And so I told a story about the what Burns' finest quality to me is this extraordinary empathy that Burns had with mostly anything, well, moose or loose or whatever, allows to anything Burns could associate with and see the world from the point of view of an animal or a human being. And I'd seen a television interview with the new president, President Obama, last time I was in the United States last year. And he was being interviewed in local television in Virginia. And incidentally, breakfast local television in America is even worse than breakfast television here. It's absolutely dreadful. In the middle of this absolutely nauseating interview, he was asked a question about what was the strongest quality his grandmother, his granny, had taught him. That's the grandmother who died, unfortunately, at the end of last year. And it was a really nauseating interview, a dreadful packed question. His answer was wonderful. He said, empathy. One word answer, empathy. Now, I don't know if the President of the United States, when he's asked that question, always gives that answer or not, but it appealed to me. And in that audience in the Library of Congress, I was talking about empathy and talked about Robert Burns. And so out of the poetry and out of the imagination and out of the things that speak to us from our national bard and our distinguished current visiting bards to this festival and our wonderful, one of the greatest traditional singers ever, in my estimation, then you've had the most extraordinary launch to this extraordinary festival. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks to Alex Salmond for his inspirational address. And also thanks to all the contributors to today's podcast. This is the end of the opening night podcast from Stanza. We'll be having another podcast tomorrow night, hopefully. And we hope for you to tune in or download or do whatever it is that allows you to come and listen. And if you happen to be in Scotland and you feel like dropping by, please feel free to come by Scotland's Poetry Festival. My name's Colin Fraser, and I'm the producer of these podcasts, with extreme thanks to Ewan McLean for permission to use his Latin jazz track for the beginning of this podcast, and to Jill Bowman for her beautiful track, The Deal's a While with the Excise Man.